Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Several bills moving through the legislature could tackle major issues that Black lawmakers have been wanting to address for years in the state. A law has already been signed this session that allows folks to get early prenatal care while they wait for Medicaid benefits to kick in. Other bills could make it easier to vote before an election, expand most parts of Medicaid, and lift lifetime voting bans on people with felonies. But the legislature is also considering bills they oppose, like a measure that would take most control of Jackson's water system away from the city. Among the lawmakers speaking at a rally outside of the Capitol building in Jackson yesterday about this issue, Democratic Representative Sakia Summers of Jackson. She says Black voters play a crucial role in holding elected officials accountable.
And also, Black voters constitute a significant and an influential voting bloc to advance issues that we're concerned about, issues like social justice, equality, and representation in the democratic process. And that's because of organizations that help us to understand what our power is and where our voice lies. And we know it lies at the ballot box. We are witnessing a different Mississippi House of Representatives this session. What was previously marked by division has embarked upon bipartisanship thanks to Speaker Jason White and the leadership. The spirit of cooperation has manifested into a piece of legislation, which is House Bill 1609. This bill will not only benefit Black voters, but all Mississippians. It's aimed at restoring voting rights to thousands of Mississippians who have been disenfranchised due to a nonviolent felony conviction. Individuals that have been disenfranchised by convictions have disproportionately impacted communities of color, particularly African American voters. Mississippi is only one of 11 states that provides a lifetime voting ban due to these felony convictions. And this bill passed by an overwhelming vote of 99-9. It is a bipartisan measure and a vote that showcases a united front in favor of democracy and second chances. Now the responsibility of House Bill 1609 falls in the Senate with our friends in the other chamber. And we hope that they will continue the momentum and provide a pathway for redemption and civic engagement for those who have paid their debts to society.
Carol Blackman is Senior State Organizing Manager with Black Voters Matter Mississippi. She speaks with our Mike McEwen about why she believes this session could be a turning point for the rights of Black voters.
We gathered here today because we feel like the legislators need to hear the voice of the people. And we are here with folk who don't always come to the Capitol. These are people from community who have said to us that they have concerns about what is happening in the State House.
Is there any legislation specifically that you're most worried about this current session?
One of the pieces we're most worried about is the Medicaid expansion. And now that it has moved from the House to the Senate and seems to be stalled in committee, we're very concerned that it moves before the next deadline on April 2nd.
I know that the Fifth Circuit Court is currently reviewing the felon disenfranchisement law in Mississippi. The legislature has also taken it up. How do you think, if that were to be repealed, and if not totally repealed, then brought back a little here in the state, how would that impact Black voters and Black communities?
If the felony ban is lifted, if the Fifth Circuit does what the three-judge panel recommended last August, we would be able to have thousands of voters who are disenfranchised at this time be a part of the voting rolls once more and be able to speak their voice at the polls.
Is there anything going on or not going on in the legislature this session that you think could impact Black voters in Mississippi moving forward?
The lack of a ballot initiative. And I know that that died in committee. We're also very concerned about expansion of the Capitol Police in the city of Jackson. We noticed last fall that several of their roadblocks occurred right around election time and what appeared to be targeted communities.
What were those communities?
Jackson State University was one of them, and south of downtown Jackson.
Are you surprised at all after what we saw happen in Hinds County with elections? Obviously, it's the state's most concentrated black population. It's the largest black voting bloc, I believe, in the country. So are you surprised that we haven't seen anything, I guess, so far that's trying to improve elections and how they're run in Hinds County?
I think we see the Hinds County Election Commission trying to do a better job, trying to be more focused, trying to receive whatever type training they need so that they will be on target and on task for the coming elections.
Something, I guess, that's been mentioned in relation to the CCID and the expansion of Capitol Police and that inferior court being created is that it's lawmakers not from Jackson, not from these communities who are passing these laws for the residents. So one speaker just today mentioned he feels the same way about this bill that's in the legislature right now about the water system. Could you just talk a little more about that and just how that feels and maybe that sense of paternalism as a Jackson resident and how it feels to have these things imposed upon you?
It really feels terribly overwhelming. It feels, as you mentioned, paternalistic. It feels like the leadership is saying and underscoring that we can't govern or take care of ourselves. However, the resources here in Hinds County, our tax revenue is being tapped to help support the expansion of CCID. So we are paying into the tax system. We are contributing to the sustainability of the state of Mississippi. So you just have to wonder how, as Rashad mentioned, people from these other areas of the state can do better in decision-making for us than we can for ourselves. And I'm reminded of the 1% tax that happened here in Jackson and how that authority was created where we can't even make decisions about when to pave a street with those resources or how to use that money to help with some of the water repairs. Well, I just want to add that as human beings, our elected officials should really think about how not to have negative impacts and suppressive ways on African American communities and claim to be wanting to help us, but rather do the right thing, let us govern ourselves, provide the support to us that they did 50 years ago in the city of Jackson.
Carol Blackman is with Black Voters Matter, Mississippi. Coming up, new tech was supposed to be the solution for Jackson's water billing issues, but a new report shows it only introduced more greed into an already fractured system. That's a report from the Gulf States Newsroom ahead. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit provides information on how you can lead a healthy lifestyle. I'm the host, Josie Bidwell. Search for and subscribe to Southern Remedy on any podcasting app to not miss any episode.
Our goal at Everyday Tech is to keep your technology not only working, but working for you. I'm the host, Abram Naney, and you can join me and my friends Wednesday mornings at 10 on MPB Think Radio. Or search Everyday Tech on your favorite podcasting app or download the MPB Public Media app.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Smart water meters often get pitched as the solution to a city's water problems. They're more accurate, they say, detect expensive water leaks early and can save a ton of money because they need fewer workers to keep track of them. That wasn't the case in Jackson. In 2013, the tech company Siemens sold Jackson smart water meters that only made the city's water problems worse. The meters failed to read water at some people's homes and sent others extremely high bills. All in all, Jackson estimated the meters cost the city $450 million. Stephen Basaha of the Gulf States Newsroom spoke with reporter Sarah Fowler about her new investigation, showing Jackson was just one of at least eight Mississippi cities harmed by the faulty water meters.
Before we get into the details about what happened with these cities, we should lay out the stakes here, because faulty water meters, they don't sound like a big deal. But Jackson alone estimates these meters costed about $450 million. How do water meters cause so much trouble?
When your water meters don't work and you're not able to send bills, water is still flowing even if you're not able to charge people for them. So when you're not able to collect those bills because the bills weren't accurate, the number keeps ringing up and keeps ringing up. It's like a cash register, right? It just keeps going and keeps going. So the $450 million is not just the price of the contract, but it's all of it together. So when you can't accurately bill, then your debt increases and a whole host of problems arise from that.
Now, the problems with Siemens have been talked about before, but always like in the context of this deal with Jackson, Mississippi. But you found that there were a bunch of other cities that also had problems with Siemens, like Macomb, a small city about 80 miles south of Jackson. What happened there?
Macomb was actually the first city that we found that signed a deal with Siemens. There is a town about 12,000 people. The meters at the very beginning, they had problems with the installation. They said, according to the mayor, the meters were put in backwards. There was one in front of the mayor's house. It was a box in the ground. And when I went last June of 2023, there was still a hole in the top of the box where the antenna was supposed to go. A hole had been drilled, but the antenna was just never installed. So you have to have the antenna in order to enable this drive-by technology. And that's where some of the savings come in for the city, because instead of having people manually going and checking, getting out of the truck, going and checking and writing it down and then getting back in the truck and driving and, you know, going all over the place, they can just drive by the meter and it's supposed to log because of that antenna. When that antenna was not installed, then that obviously slowed the process down.
So basically, these water meters did not work as promised in Macomb, and it cost the city a ton of money. And despite all that, Jackson got into its own deal with Siemens in 2013. Considering all that went wrong in Macomb, how did this deal not get squashed?
So the mayor of Macomb said to me that he actually called a member of the city council and told them to run. He said that, you know, nobody ever called him back on that, but there didn't seem to be a lot of questions that were asked at the time. But what you have to remember, too, is that Jackson was in a desperate situation. They felt like their back was against the wall. They were hemorrhaging money, and they needed to have their bills paid. Like, they needed the water to work. They needed to be able to bill people properly and people to be able to pay those bills. They needed this revenue stream coming in.
What really struck me about your investigation was, again, I would often, when I hear about the Siemens deal, it's always in the frame of Jackson. It seemed like a Jackson-only problem. But you went through and you found that, yeah, there were more cities that had these issues and had their own bad deals with Siemens.
If you think about it, I mean, who knows about water meters, right? Like, if you had told me a year ago that I would know the ins and outs of water meters, I mean, come on, right? But this is what I've been doing, and so I can have a conversation about it. Most people on a city council, they're busy with balancing budgets or dealing with, you know, personnel on a school board or things of that nature. They're not focused on the day-to-day of how your water department works. So when you have someone who claims to be an expert in their field coming and saying, hey, this is how we can accurately measure your water, save you money and make you money, and you don't have to pay for it. You know, they're saying that these meters would pay for themselves, right? That sounds like a great idea. But it wasn't just Siemens. And I think that's what's important, is it wasn't just Siemens that was going around and doing this to cities across Mississippi. There were multiple companies that went through and sold meters that didn't do what they promised.
What could these cities or the state of Mississippi have done to prevent this?
I don't know what the cities could have done. I wasn't in that position. But I will say all of these projects went through the Mississippi Development Authority. And Cleveland, Mississippi in particular, reached out to the Mississippi Development Authority and told them that they were hemorrhaging money and that they could not afford to go on the way that they were. And the attorney for the city of Cleveland said that they never heard back from anyone at MDA. So MDA knew that this was happening, and yet it continued.
The Gulf States Newsroom, that was Sarah Fowler talking to Stephen Pasaha. And you can read her full investigation at the New York Times and Mississippi Today websites. The Gulf States Newsroom is a partnership among Mississippi Public Broadcasting and public radio stations in Alabama and Louisiana. Next, a student of history examines the many ways women contributed to the civil rights movement. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit provides information on how you can lead a healthy lifestyle. I'm the host, Josie Bidwell. Search for and subscribe to Southern Remedy on any podcasting app to not miss any episode.
We are filled with gratitude to the gracious people who stepped up to tell MPB they love the idea of having Think Radio in their lives. If you missed your opportunity to take part, just visit mpbonline.org. Again, thanks from all of us at MPB.
No matter if you use an app to start your car or still have a flip phone, Everyday Tech can decipher today's technology for tomorrow's solutions. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or the MPB Public Media app.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. A professor who works at the State University of New York in Geneseo is highlighting the contributions of women and what they did for the civil rights movement. Her name is Emily Crosby, and it is the New York University in Geneseo. She talks about the essential work on the grassroots level that all of these women did in the 1960s. She says they led the way in desegregating schools, voter registration, and spoke on the national scale about the need to end racial discrimination. And she's going to be speaking today at History is Lunch at the two Mississippi museums in Jackson at noon.
I think a lot of people, their impression of the civil rights movement, they're accustomed to seeing male leadership. You know, I think obviously Dr. King is the most visible person. But if if I ask my students or if I ask a general audience to name women who were important in the civil rights movement, they generally get pretty stuck after Rosa Parks, maybe Coretta Scott King. It's probably no accident that both of those women, although they did really important things, were both connected to Dr. King, and that may have something to do with their visibility. But that's just really the tip of the iceberg, not even the tip of the iceberg. We know that women, if you look at pictures of the movement, they are full of women. We know that women came out for the movement more often than men in most communities and most of the time. Women were more likely to volunteer to register to vote early. They went to mass meetings. They canvassed and talked to their neighbors and tried to get them involved. They helped the movement feel like a family. They did, the work that needed doing. But a lot of that is invisible. And SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a group that was founded out of the sit-ins in 1960, they were brought together by Ella Baker, who was, one of the most important long-term activists. And she thought that it was important to bring this student energy together and give them a chance to, see if they wanted to be an organization and where they would go. And that ended up being SNCC. Initially they're doing direct action sit-ins. They were very important in the Freedom Rides. But in summer of 1961, they began to work on voter registration. And they did that not by going into cities like Birmingham, Atlanta, where it would be relatively safe. I don't want to overstate that. Obviously, none of those places were entirely safe. But instead, they went into rural Mississippi.
Dangerous territory.
Dangerous territory, absolutely. Amzie Moore had said to SNCC, the sit-ins are great, but what we really need is political power. And to get that, we need voter registration. So SNCC come in, and the first project they do on voter registration is in Macomb in summer of 1961. And then they go into the Delta in the summer of 1962. And one of the things that made SNCC different in how they approached this was that they were really looking to work with local people, and they were open to everyone. They were looking for leadership from everyone. So they didn't assume that to be a leader, you had to be a man. They didn't assume that to be a leader, you had to be educated or economically well off or have status in the community. And that meant that SNCC was receptive to women's leadership in a way that other organizations just weren't. You know, if you think about it, at the time that SNCC comes into Mississippi in the early 1960s, it was still legal to discriminate against women in hiring. There were still quotas for women to get into higher education. And of course, that's all women. And there's even more discrimination against African-American women. But SNCC just ignored or directly challenged many of those societal norms. And they partly the movement needed everybody it could get to help out.
Is this the bulk of what you're going to talk about?
That, and I'm also going to talk about, you know, some of the community women. So there are women like Mrs. Hamer. So she's an example of the kind of leadership that SNCC is receptive to. SNCC meets Mrs. Hamer in summer of 1962. She comes to a mass meeting. And when they ask for volunteers to try to register to vote, she volunteers. And she goes on a bus with about 16 or so people. And they get to Indianola. And they only let a couple people try to register. One of them is Miss Hamer. On the way back, white lawmen stop the bus, and they basically say the driver is driving a bus the wrong color. It looks too much like a school bus. That's their excuse for stopping them. And they've got the SNCC staffers, and they're kind of talking to them, arresting them. Meanwhile, the local people on the bus are trying to raise money among themselves to pay a fine on the spot so that the driver can carry them home. So while this is going on, people are really terrified. And the SNCC people remember this woman just starting to sing songs. And she sang, as they said, one church song after another. Well, that turned out to be Miss Hamer. And in doing that, she really helped people, you know, get through that, calm their fears. Of course, many people know this story, but by the time she got home that night, she was met by the plantation owner. And he said, basically, you have to take your name off of that list to try to register, or you have to leave in the morning. And she said, you know, I didn't register for you. I registered for myself. I'm not taking it off. And so she left that night. You know, she had lived there for 18 years, worked as a timekeeper and a sharecropper. And she had to leave her husband and children because he had to stay until the crop was brought in. And then, of course, he was kicked off, too. So she goes and stays with some friends. And within a couple weeks, her house where she's staying is shot at. That same night, a couple of other people were actually hit.
Have you found that Fannie Lou Hamer is more well-known than maybe some other women in the movement? And they also seem to put Coretta Scott King in that category. Was she not more of a housewife?
Yeah, so those are great questions. Yeah, Mrs. Hamer is definitely more well-known than most women, but I think she represents, in some ways you don't want to say she represents something because she's so, you know, central in her own person. But the fact that she's a woman with a sixth grade education and SNCC is receptive to her leadership, not just to talking to her neighbors, but also becoming a spokesperson for the organization, running for Congress. I think that that's a good example of the kind of leadership that was available that SNCC recognized and was able to support and work with. And so Ms. Hamer does become well known, but there are, you know, dozens and hundreds of other women that are similar, not as high profile, but similar in the kind of contributions they made locally within their community.
Emily Crosby, you're going to be talking about this issue at History is Lunch at noon today at the two Mississippi museums.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it.
And we appreciate your time.
Oh, I'm delighted to talk to you. I really appreciate your interest.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.